I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, I have a conversation with Isosa Osa, the founder and CEO of Onyx Impact, an organization that fights the harmful information ecosystems that target Black communities. Isosa joins me to discuss how misinformation and disinformation campaigns impact Black voters. In our conversation, Isosa explains how disinformation campaigns were used to depress Black turnout during the 2016 election and again in the 2020 midterm cycle. She also explains how they've evolved to be even more effective in the current election cycle. We also talk about TikTok, Facebook, and of course Twitter, and how AI is quickly evolving, which only makes detecting disinformation harder. So, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Isosa Osa. Isosa Osa, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I'm so happy to be here.
You know, I'm really excited to have this conversation because I have followed you on social media for a while. And I'm always excited when I get to, you know, have a conversation with someone that I only know virtually or through social media because I get to have an in-depth conversation and get to know them better. But, you know, I have a confession. I did not know you were a disinformation and misinformation expert until this was scheduled. I knew that you worked for the Stacey Abrams campaign, but I didn't know that you were an expert here, right? I'm excited about that. So tell me, when did you decide that you wanted to focus your expertise on misinformation and disinformation? Was there a specific moment or a specific election cycle?
That's a great question. I think that at my time at Fair Fight Action as Deputy Executive Director and Research Director, we began seeing in the lead up to the 2020 election a lot of incorrect, false, misleading information about how to vote, about mail-in voting, about, you know, false cases of voter fraud. And this was something we'd never seen on that scale. And when we were, you know, really researching and tracking the Trump operation, they were saying publicly or in closed sessions that their goal was to uplift those instances or cases, false cases of voter fraud, to a national stage in order to discredit the elections and make voting into something that should be policed. And so this was very concerning. And when we did even more research on it, we discovered that it's actually very effective to tell people things that are not true on a large scale. And that's what this entire kind of disinformation, misinformation apparatus is. And to be clear, what we're talking about here, misinformation is incorrect information that may be accidentally shared, such as incorrect polling locations or hours shared by mistake. Disinformation is when there's intent involved. It's lies with the intent to lie. And so that's actively pushing incorrect polling locations and hours to folks to try to prevent them from voting. And so in the lead up to 2020 and 2020 cycle, we found ourselves, because there was so much false and misleading information about voting being spread, having to become disinformation experts and work with, you know, the broader counter disinfo community to explain to people how this works, how to fight back, how to not amplify false narratives, which we're, you know, still working to do well. But it really became in 2020 a core part of what our view of voter protection was, making sure we were protecting voters from a sea, an inundation of voting disinformation throughout that cycle.
You know, I'm so glad that you defined the two, because that was going to be my next question. So we're talking about 2020 here, but we know that disinformation and misinformation was a part of the political discourse back in 2016, right? So this is 2020. So when you started pulling those threads in 2020, what did you find? What was the source of that disinformation specifically in that campaign?
Well, it wasn't, you know, necessarily hard to find, given that a lot of the far right and the Trump campaign was actively, gladly amplifying disinformation on the biggest platforms in the world. And part of the reason why disinformation is so dangerous is because, for the most part, our brains work in a similar fashion. And that is that, you know, the more times we hear something, the more likely we are to believe that it's true. And the more likely we are to believe other people believe it's true as well. And so the repetition and amplification of that repetition that you get when someone is sharing misleading information at the presidential podium level is so extraordinary that it is no surprise that so many people believed it and to this day still believe so many of these false narratives. I mean, if the president of the United States with that massive platform came out every single day and told us that the sky is green, at a certain point, we are all going to walk outside and look up and be like, I'm not sure. Right. And so that's why all of the research into how disinformation and propaganda spreads, it starts off with, please don't do it. It's almost impossible to put this back in the box. Once you start spreading it, it becomes a force of its own. And we've seen what that looks like in our politics today.
Right. So those were domestic sources. And I think we're kind of all aware of those with conservatives spreading lies about voter fraud and other lies about voters. But were you able to uncover any kind of foreign sources of disinformation in 2020 or in any other election cycle?
Yeah. So I think one of the more famous cases of disinformation happened in the 2016 cycle with the Facebook group Blacktivist. That was a Russian-backed, basically massive Facebook group that sought to increase divisions within Black communities and between communities overall. And so you saw that Facebook group be one of the more active Facebook groups we had in that cycle around issues of Black and progressive politics. And to find out after the cycle that that was entirely inauthentic, pushing people into disengagement, pushing people into more extreme spaces was really disturbing. And that's, you know, part of the reason I founded Onyx Impact to map and understand how disinformation affects Black communities is because there hasn't really been a ton of progress or information or study done in terms of how disinformation continues to affect Black communities, despite Black communities being, you know, one of the earliest and most aggressive targets. There's a broader lack of curiosity and care into Black voters that seeps into, you know, this field of research as well. And we're hoping to change that. And there's certainly, you know, Black focused YouTube channels, influencers, what have you, that are very much backed by foreign state actors that we should all be concerned with. And, you know, I believe there was an article a few weeks ago that spoke about how Russia had launched a disinformation campaign in Mississippi to spread separatist views into that community in ways that we had seen maybe happen in the Cold War. And that kind of goes to show that foreign actors are testing these tactics in Black communities, not necessarily in battleground states. And so if we're going to be serious about pushing back and fighting, we need to be serious about understanding the Black community and the Black electorate as a whole and all of the unique parts that make it up, because these different Black audiences are being targeted in different ways.
So that's really interesting. Do we know how this happens? So for instance, you know, the 2016 Blacktivist Facebook group. So I'm curious as to who sets up a group like that and also how we uncovered it, but also going back to the YouTube groups. When I see these YouTube channels, when I see these channels, this is why I think disinformation is so fascinating. I know that there's something amiss here, and I know there's something nefarious here, but I don't know what it is, right? I don't know who's behind it. Now we know that Russia's behind some of these. How did these even get started? Are these people approached by someone from Russia? Like, do we really know what the genesis of these channels and these groups are? Like, how do they form?
I'm sure sometimes folks are approached. I'm sure sometimes at the beginning and probably in 2016, it's more, you know, creating false, fake personalities, right, to set up these pages and having troll farms, bot farms, what have you, begin creating false engagement and having algorithms pick up on that engagement and push those pages, those groups, what have you, to other people. And so a lot of the times that happens. And, you know, I think when we've all experienced, I think, what you're talking about, like something about this doesn't look right. Right. And that probably means that the disinformation is primarily being created and disseminated by actors not of our community. Right. That's why you don't necessarily, you might not get the language right, or you might not get the topic exactly right. But, you know, it's a much more dangerous proposition when you're talking about folks, foreign or domestic actors, right, paying or influencing folks in our community that do understand our culture, speak the same way we do, understand topics in the same way we do. When those folks are now the ones pushing incorrect or misleading information in our community, it's done in a much more believable way. And I think moving forward, you see disinformation campaigns more and more use audiences within the constituency they're targeting to make it a far more effective campaign. And, you know, as we incorporate artificial intelligence and generative AI incorporated into these online spaces as well, we're going to get to the point where it's going to be very difficult to tell the difference between authentic and inauthentic actors behind these accounts.
Yeah. So sorry to go on about this, but I'm still really curious. So it's one thing to have an account, and we've all seen these like on Twitter or like on Facebook, where it's kind of faceless, right? And these people are trying to mimic Black language so that it comes across as something that's credible. That's one thing, because it's faceless and we don't really know who's behind it or whether they're authentic or not. But when you have someone who's on camera, that seems like a harder thing to set up, right? So you have a guy, let's say, you know, he's been approached by someone to set up a YouTube channel. Someone has to go into their studio or their home and sit in front of a camera and repeat these talking points. And I'm just curious as to how that happens. You know, are checks sent? Does someone call him on the phone and say, hey, I want you to set up this YouTube channel and, you know, repeat this disinformation and here's a script? Like, do we actually know how that happens?
So I don't want to overly pontificate or guess as to exactly how people are approached to push misleading content. But what I will say is that it doesn't necessarily have to be much different than the kind of influencer economy we already have, right? Of approaching someone that has a large audience, asking someone to promote a product or promote an idea, and being able to capture their audience and their reach in that fashion. And so if we see how quickly and how seamlessly it can be done for non-nefarious means, I think that those are probably similar means as to how it happens for these false narratives as well.
So you mentioned 2020, and now we're in another major political cycle, presidential cycle, 2024. What have you seen, or how have you seen things shift or evolve between 2020 and now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a couple of really important changes that as it relates to kind of the disinformation ecosystem affecting Black voters in particular. One is that there is a significant amount of very genuine Black voter discontent, right? That comes from a host of different issues or problems. And the ramification of that very genuine voter discontent is that it creates a environment for disinformation to seed and grow, because disinformation works best in audiences that are distrustful, disengaged, and fear-based. And so when you have so much discontent in an audience, it's ripe to be for disinformation to be able to spread more easily. And so I think that's one change from 2020 to 2024. Another difference is that we are seeing far more sophisticated campaigns to all communities, disinformation campaigns, but especially in Black communities, as it relates to who is already in these spaces, what types of content, disinformation content to push to them. The increased sophistication has happened for a host of reasons that, you know, I'm happy to get into, but it's going to mean that it's going to be harder to stop, harder to push back on, and more important than ever to be spreading good information, to be supporting and uplifting trust messengers and trusted media sources and Black media sources ahead of this election. So I think that's also a major difference. And then generative AI is another significant change from 2020 to 2024. We're now at a point where, you know, you can create individual persuasion campaigns and operations for specific people. And what we're seeing broadly is the cost of spreading disinformation is approaching zero across the world, while the cost of accessing truth, accessing real information, is becoming more and more expensive, whether it be by subscription or finding trusted messengers or doing multiple source checks. It's becoming harder to get accurate information. And that puts us at an inherent disadvantage, right, in this current media ecosystem. We do need to find ways to make sure that folks have just as much access to good information as they do bad. And then the last change I would say from 2020-2024 is that social media companies, tech companies have rolled back so many policies that were put in place to protect voters, right? They've used all types of not great arguments as to why less protections are needed. And so we're going to see these platforms be used in more nefarious ways. And it's really disappointing because these are companies that are getting billions of dollars off of our information while just refusing to share any of their own. And given what we saw in previous election cycles, and we saw false claims about elections and political violence against Black election workers and election officials be directly linked, right? The social media companies can't pretend as if there's no link between the false claims that we saw and the violence we saw and the harassment we saw against Black election workers and Black election officials. And so we need to hold them to account before, during, and after elections for the false information they allow to spread, and push back on any attempt to take no responsibility or have no accountability for what happens on their platforms.
So when you say tech companies, do you mean Twitter? Or I guess X, as he likes to call it now? I'm assuming that's who you mean. Or if you have other examples, that would be great.
So definitely, definitely Twitter.
I put you on the spot, sorry.
No worries. I think there was a free press article that showed that across Meta, X, YouTube, all those channels had eliminated 17 critical policies that helped keep disinformation in check over just the past year. And we've seen, you know, multiple companies just gut the teams that are responsible for fighting this mis and disinformation across the board. And so it's not just X. And as a matter of fact, for Black communities, for far more Black folks are on Facebook than on Twitter. The platforms of YouTube and Facebook and TikTok, you know, often dwarf the size of X. And so we need to make sure that we're in the spaces where our communities are when we're talking about this, but we can't allow these social media companies to create environments of hate, harassment, you know, misleading information that disproportionately target communities of color without being held to account for what flows, you know, unimpeded across their platform.
So, you know, this may be a naive question, but why would Facebook specifically do this and take down all the guardrails, given the amount of criticism they received after the 2016 elections? Why? Like, what's in it for them?
So that's a great question. And what we saw happen was a really aggressive, concerted campaign by the far right to significantly influence the policy, the platforms, and the people in these organizations, including Facebook. I know that they hired one of their top folks on their policy team, you know, conservative Trump activists. There was a push by the right to, a very successful push, to claim that these guardrails were that preventing mis and disinformation was censoring their constituency, was censoring a form of free speech. And so they were attacked nonstop on these claims and acquiesced to this conservative campaign to undo these guardrails. And so that's what happened, not just at Facebook, but at other social media companies, was a bowing to the political pressure of, you know, some of the same folks that were not pushing back against the misleading information that we saw in the 2016 and 2020 cycle.
You know, you mentioned AI, which everyone is really kind of afraid of, especially in the context of politics, just because it's so new. We don't fully know how it works, and we don't fully know how it's going to be used. And right now, in the context of politics, it's not being used for anything good, right? There was this image, and I don't know if you saw this, there was this image that was floating around a couple of weeks ago with Trump, with a group of Black people. And I think the caption with that photo was that, you know, these were Black voters for Trump.
And, you know, people outed that image as being clearly fake, being clearly an AI generated image. I think some of the people had like 8 fingers on one hand. I mean, it was it was clearly a fake image, an AI generated image, you know, speaking of fake news. You know, I guess my question around that is that, you know, it's going to get better. What are we going to do? And I guess what are, you know, organizations like yours going to do, or maybe the government should be involved in stopping AI from disrupting, you know, our politics and our democracy?
So that's a great question. And to take a step back, I think it's important to see these as tools, powerful tools that are being pushed by various tech companies to across all types of industries. And we already use artificial intelligence when you think about facial recognition, medical imaging, autocomplete. All of these rely on AI and software's kind of ability to replicate patterns. So AI basically means something that can replicate patterns over and over and over again. Generative AI is different in that it's able to generate new content from human inputs. And so it doesn't just replicate patterns, it learns from patterns and produces new content, which is a much more kind of powerful probabilistic model that it uses. And, you know, one of the things that we should be concerned about is that these tools, there's a lot of good that can be used and be done from AI and generative AI. And we should, you know, I want to make sure that we take full use of those and not be afraid of AI. But at the same time, understand that these products, these tools are going to make big tech far more powerful. And we need to be careful about how they talk about the power of these products. You'll see them trying to humanize AI, make it into the same thing as a human or a brain. But, you know, this is not the case. By doing that, they basically make themselves seem even more powerful. So we got to be careful about that. We have to be careful about the fact that, you know, bad actors are already experimenting with these products. And as you said, you talked about those Trump images, you know, it's also the case that ChatGPT-4 is creating more believable news headlines than actual news organizations for people. And so it's going to become increasingly difficult to tell the difference between authentic and inauthentic content. And that's why it's going to be even more important to have trusted messengers, trusted news sources that are available for free across the board to all types of voters. So, you know, that's one concern. You know, another concern with AI is that it has the ability to mislead voters in a much more sophisticated way by, as I said before, kind of micro targeting folks with highly customized inputs for each and every user, or creating for a lot of users, creating fake events. You know, there, such as a few weeks ago, an image was an AI generated image was pushed about a false Pentagon explosion that saw the stock market dip. And it took a bit of time for folks to realize or to prove that it was a fake AI generated photo. And so those types of events, you know, happening near elections can cause all types of confusion and concern. So, you know, AI is going to allow more bad actors to produce, you know, a high volume of more sophisticated, inauthentic and problematic content. And it's going to, you know, make tech companies even more powerful. But we should still look for opportunities to use and amplify the good application of AI when we can, and make sure that we understand that this is a tool created by humans. It's a computer program. Like, it's not a person. There's no need to overstate the power of these tools. We just need to educate folks on how to use them properly and how to be properly skeptical about the information they see.
I totally agree with you that, you know, AI can be a force for good. I mean, full disclosure, I use AI for editing, you know, my podcast. And, you know, there are other really good applications for AI, right? But then again, as you've mentioned, that there are some really kind of nefarious ways that we could use AI. And I feel like possibly some level of regulation needs to happen And I'm not sure what that'll look like or when it will happen. Is that a possibility?
From your mouth to God's ears, like, I am always hopeful that we can create and have much needed policy and guardrails around these massive improvements and changes in technology. And other countries are, you know, putting in place guidelines and policies to help mitigate the impact of generative AI and the spread of disinformation. We in the United States have not been as successful. Our process also doesn't allow us to be as fast as we need to be when we see how quickly this stuff comes on online and becomes, you know, incredibly big and powerful. And so they just passed a bill to ban TikTok, you know, how many years after it came out, when all of the harms of that platform were known from the very beginning. We chose, you know, an election cycle where we need a lot of young folks to come out and vote as the time to, you know, potentially take away their favorite thing. And it is just another example of how we're in the United States not rising to the challenge of regulating these potentially harmful technologies and tools.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about TikTok. I mean, what are you saying, that we should have regulated TikTok or even banned it earlier? Like, what's your take on TikTok? How harmful is it?
I think that TikTok, it has obviously opened a lot of doors for a lot of people and allowed people to engage in new and innovative and wonderful ways. And I also recognize that it has some serious national security implications of having that platform owned by another state actor. And in addition, it's not necessarily TikTok, but it is their process, the way that the information is shared on it, with these, you know, short videos that glide from one to the next, similar to Instagram Reels, right? Both of those platforms make it easier and faster to kind of digest bad information very, very quickly, right? You get that repetition and that amplification far faster than you do, you know, scrolling by yourself. You're far more likely to get, you know, referred to similar content. And so by its nature, it's harmful, and by its ownership, it's harmful. And so I think that especially if those things are known from the beginning, you have a window to act, you absolutely should. But, you know, there's also a public part of, you know, passing policy. And I think that we're not doing a great job right now of making the argument as to why this should be done now, and what to say to folks that have created businesses, personalities, social communities on these platforms.
Right, right. I get what you're saying. You know, it's funny, this is kind of meta, but I've always wondered whether the disinformation around the take on the necessity of TikTok was actually disinformation itself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't have a personal TikTok account. I'm not necessarily, you know, ruling it out forever, but I definitely understand the appeal and the power and the strength of that platform.
So, you know, one of the things that really bothers me, and I'm sorry to go back to foreign influence campaigns, but it's something that really bothers me. You know, and we're talking about Black people and Black voters being, you know, the targets of those disinformation campaigns. Like, how do they know so much about us to be able to mimic things and then produce this believable disinformation, right? It bothers me that they're kind of studying us, they're watching us. Like, how does this happen?
It's a great question, and hopefully it'll make you feel a little bit better about it. They don't know about Black folks. You know, they're guessing on a lot of it. That's why, you know, so much of it is bad, and so much of it that they spread doesn't necessarily work. And you know, a few years ago, we would often see, like, right before the elections, you know, very bad, poorly created, obviously inauthentic and foreign pushes, you know, with someone, a Black guy is like, "Don't vote, bruh," or something along those lines. That, you know, it's just like, this is their best, this is the best effort that they got. And what's changed is a few things. One, unfortunately, COVID-19 created, and the disinformation around COVID-19 created immense opportunity for folks that wanted to spread disinformation in communities and Black communities, because it was so, the disinformation around COVID-19 was so successful, it pulled so many people from so many different communities into disinformation spaces. And so instead of having to target, you know, a wide range of Black folks, these campaigns could target folks that they know were already susceptible to other types of disinformation, right? So the pool got smaller and more powerful. And then in addition, we have all types of new technologies that we just talked about, artificial intelligence, generative AI, that has the ability to just to what we call A/B test a ton of messages at once, right? So if you may not know what the right message is to a specific type of Black voter, but you may know that it's probably one of these 400. And if you can test all 400 of those messages to find the one that fits very quickly, right, it reduces the need to have to do the level of learning about these communities that are necessary to inauthentically persuade them. So the good news is that they still don't know about us. they are finding ways around it.
Yeah, I guess the clue is if you come across some content and it sounds like me trying to be cool, trying to be cool with my kid and not be called cringe, it's probably,
yes.
Probably disinformation. So, you know, what do we do for 2024, right? You know, in closing, how do we detect it? How do we protect ourselves from it? What's a good rule of thumb if you are a voter, particularly a Black voter who comes across a piece of information? First of all, I'll just say this. My rule of thumb is that if I come across some content and it is nudging me in a direction that is not in my interest, not in my best interest, trying to convince me not to vote, trying to convince me that like voting isn't important, that civic engagement isn't important, or that I should do something or vote in a way that is against my best interest, my own best interest, I just don't trust it, right? I can't be certain that it's disinformation, but I don't trust it. So what's your take on what we should all do going into 2024 to both protect ourselves and to, you know, tease out this disinformation?
So that's an excellent question. And I think that there are a few things that we can all do. I think that you're absolutely right. It's important to be, you know, a little skeptical, especially of narratives that dissuade Black voters from using their power. I think those narratives that folks hear that kind of go down that line that it should be examined, you should think twice too. It's important to make sure that we're just on high alert, if that makes sense, for the fact that information may not be true, or to check sources. Just simply telling people to be on the lookout for mis or disinformation or to check sources actually makes it so that they are far more likely to do it for about 3 days. So that needs to be kind of a constant message to folks in our community to be vigilant. I would also say we need to invest in Black media and Black trusted messengers. Again, it's going to become increasingly more important in this type of election cycle with this much disinformation that can be spread, for folks to know who they can go to for good information and who they can trust. You know, I'd also say that not just as it relates to politics, but as it relates to all types of narratives, we should be asking ourselves, like, does this unnecessarily spread fear or divide Black folks, or you know, is this narrative harmful in that way? And if it is, then it's likely, one, you probably don't want to reshare it into your own community, into your own spaces. And two, it is likely making that space more susceptible to disinformation moving forward. Like, even if it's something, you know, about gender wars or health or what have you, those types of divisive topics can make spaces far more susceptible to other types of contentious narratives that may not be true being pushed on that same platform.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you mentioned that, you know, going to Black media, going directly to Black media. I think the Biden-Harris administration has been trying to do that. And I think that they've gotten a lot of criticism for that, for, I guess, pandering is how people are framing it. But it is one way to get past all of this kind of disinformation content, is to go directly to Black media outlets. And isn't that something we want them to do, to invest in these outlets? So
yes, yes. And if they get accused of pandering, guess what? Do it again. And then do it again. And then do it again. Right? Like, it's pandering because people don't see it enough. And so it's, of course, the first couple of times you're on the Shade Room, people are going to say you're pandering. But hell, if you're there every day, I'm not telling the Biden campaign to be on the Shade Room every day. Just be 100% clear about that. Yeah, no, it is necessary to keep going back, to keep making an argument, to keep kind of coming through for Black folks. And like, if folks say you're pandering, they're probably still going to remember what you did for them. So.
Precisely. Well, Sosa Osa, it's been a pleasure, a true pleasure to talk to you. This has been really informative. And just thank you so much for all the work that you've been doing, and for, you know, bringing Onyx to, you know, to us, you know, to help us navigate this, you know, time, this very troubling time. Anyhow, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. And apologies for all my long answers. I appreciate it.
It's fine.